welcome to the Soccer Coaching Podcast, brought to you in association with our friends at Soccer Coach Weekly, reflecting our shared ambition to help coaches have the most effective, enjoyable and successful coaching journey for them and their players. We hope you enjoyed this episode and thanks for listening. Jamie, welcome back to the podcast. How are you doing, my friend?
Yeah, thank you for having me. Yeah, very good. Thank you. Yeah, thanks very much.
Well, again, like when we get returning guests on, we always look back and think, when did we last speak? And I was thinking it must have been a couple of years ago at least. And I think it's just over 4 years ago. So how time flies.
It really does. Yeah. I was thinking about it today as well. And I was thinking, well, it's 4 years have gone by so quickly.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
Well, look, we'll cover some of that ground in the next 45 minutes to an hour or so, I'm sure. Not all of it, because I'm sure loads of things have gone on. That was pre-COVID as well, so it was a whole different time back then. But thank you so much for agreeing to be a guest on the podcast. This is a topic that I've wanted to cover for a while, but genuinely, I wanted the right person, and you were, for me, the best fit for this. So, like, talking around, you know, the adult game and then how we can link some of that well back into youth football and like, the younger players, you know, because it's always a dangerous field, isn't it? It's kind of that almost, you know, the adult game is not the young game kind of thing. But actually, there is some correlation of things that we should be thinking about potentially. And given, you know, where you have your different hats in different areas, you seem like the ideal person for this. So no pressure. Great. But are you up for the challenge?
Oh, very much so. Yeah, thanks. Yeah. Got a lot to live up to now.
Yeah, that's it. It picked you up. Look, well, I'm sure you do a cracking job, but let's see where we land anyway. But before we start, and in case people haven't caught on, you're on episode 17 and we covered kind of all the work you were doing, wonderful work you are still doing at Brentford. But, you know, we're going to obviously move slightly away from that. But for those that haven't listened to episode 17 or don't know you, just a bit about like your coaching and managing background and your journey up to this point, if that's okay.
Yeah, sure. So, currently, I'll start from now. So currently, I'm Senior Manager of Football Development at Brentford FC Community Sports Trust. I'm also the first team manager of Ascot United, who are newly promoted to step four in the football pyramid. So,
it's running a little cheer thing when there's a little, I press a button, it goes cheers in the background and claps and stuff like that. I haven't got one, so I'll just clap myself.
Yeah, well, we finally got there, finally got the promotion. Over sort of the last, 13, 14 years, I have been at Brentford and I've been coaching for and working for them full time. And my experiences in coaching have been quite varied in terms of specific football sessions, which could be after-school clubs, they could be more development centre-focused, as well as teaching PE in primary schools and other education programmes in secondary schools. So very much working with young people for many, many years. And as my journey progressed with Brentford, I joined the academy set up at the time. I was coaching academy footballers. So I've had quite a varied experience working with elite players in multiple age groups up to, youth development phase and also beginners that are there to have fun and just enjoy the game.
That doesn't get much boring, that does it? Like all levels, all age groups. And a lot of experience at Brentford. I know you've been there for a number of years, but that's quite unique to stick at one place. So how's Brentford managed to keep you? What's the magic there that's going on?
Oh, the badge. Yeah. It's a brilliant.
Oh, you sold yourself straight away there.
it's a brilliant football club. I think everyone knows that Brentford Football Club has had a unique journey in itself. And as a community sports trust, we've been able to continue progressing and expanding and growing and offering varied projects and programs over the course of the season. Over the course of the last few years, especially the last few seasons, given now we're a Premier League club. So when I first joined Brentford and the Community Sports Trust, we were a League Two club. So the infrastructure has completely changed. The access to funding has changed. It's allowed us to develop our current programs whilst offering new ones. So it's always a changing environment, which has kept me involved and intrigued and infused. So, and if I focus more on our football program in particular, only 6-7 years ago, we had about 180 participants that trained with us weekly. Now we're over 1,300 at full capacity at all of our venues, plus a huge, huge waiting list of players looking to join. So we're just trying our very best to get as many young people playing the game, enjoying the game, whilst learning as well.
Well, I think it's great that you on your own have taken Brentford from the League Two to the Premier League, mate. Well done, you.
Thank you. I'd love, to take any kind of credit, but it's been an unbelievable journey.
You are the most humble person I think I've met. So you would never claim any responsibility for that. But I know you and the team work super hard behind the scenes in loads of things that have an impact on the badge more broadly and keeping a good reputation, the good image in the community. So congratulations on everything, because you deserve it. And obviously that focus is, you know, around very much coaching and development and a wide range of, you know, age groups, but all, you know, players kind of on the start of their journey, I guess, in many ways. What about the work at ASL again? Because that's the other side of the coin, I guess. How has that come about? And can you talk us a bit about, you know, how you got into ASL before it's about, like, maybe last season, just kind of how that unfolded?
Yeah, sure. So I originally got involved through a friend of mine. I was never looking to be involved in first team football at senior level in the semi-pro game. And I was at a youth competition in Sweden, the Gothia Cup. And I was helping a friend, and whilst I was out there, I met someone called Neil Richards, who was involved at Ascot United. And the team I was sort of working with out there happened to have a lot of Ascot United under 18 players. So an opportunity to get involved in the under 23s development squad at the football club became available after that competition. We did really well, so I think that helped. We managed to get to the semi-finals and get the bronze medal, which is out of about, I don't know, I think maybe 200-300 teams. And that then opened the door to get involved at Ascot United. Very quickly, after 6 months, we had the opportunity to manage the first team. The first team management previous to us had left. I was the assistant manager. And then after a year, I took over as first team manager. So it all happened very, very quickly, unexpectedly. And I wasn't looking for it. But in the end, I needed something that sparked that competitive edge in me, because we all know youth football is not just about the results, is it? It's about the development. It's about enjoyment. It's about participating. And when that opportunity came, I got the bug to really work hard for something in terms of 3 points at the end of a Saturday. So, yeah. You know, I'm into my sixth season now at Ascot United.
Is it really that long? I didn't know. I thought it was like three or four again. So that's six seasons. Wow. Very good. Well, look, tell us if you can then about how last season went, if that's all right. For
Ascot. Of course, yeah. An unbelievable season for those that are not aware of the football club. So Ascot United is one of the largest football clubs in the country. We've got close to 100 teams from under sixes all the way through to vets teams, plus a huge girls pathway, women's teams. So for us, it was always about trying to match the ambition on the pitch as well as that off the pitch. And last year, really, we kicked on, and we finally achieved what we wanted to, which is a promotion from Step 5 football, the Combined Counties Premier Division. And we've been promoted into the Isthmian League, which is a huge, huge step for the football club. But also alongside that, we had that small trip to Wembley Stadium. And we, at Step 5 football, you enter the FA Vars competition, which is a smaller version of the FA Cup. So you have the FA Cup as the you know, the premier competition for the FA. Then you've got the FA Trophy for some non-league teams. And you've got the FA Vars for some of the lower-end non-league clubs. So it's a huge competition, huge, huge. It's about 500, 600 teams that enter it across the country. And we managed to get to the final. We played at Wembley Stadium in front of a crowd of 28,000 people. And we won. So it was an unbelievable season. Incredible just to have that whole experience of success and winning the league promotion and the FA Vars. You couldn't have asked for more.
At the start of the season, I don't know if you can be honest or not, whether you had ambitions, but did you have targets? I mean, some managers will set themselves like, you know, we're going to win the league, we're going to do the cup, we're going to do this. Or were you, you know, very much kind of like, well, let's just game by game, let's see how we get on and where we can land? Or, you know, what were your targets at the start of the season?
We had the target of promotion. So we really wanted to focus on it because we've been building up to that for the last few years. And when COVID happened, and the football completely stopped. We were first place in the league at that time. So we were denied promotion then. So that was, we're talking three seasons ago. So since then, we've been trying to replicate that and actually can finish the job. So promotion was always the goal. It was always the target, whether that was either winning the league outright as first place winners or going through the playoffs. So we didn't put that pressure on our players to say we have to win the league. It was, we're going for promotion. So we could afford to finish second, it could have been. But we got first anyway. And never in our wildest dreams did we think we'd win the FA Vars. We thought, obviously, we wanted to be competitive.
Yeah.
But we had to win 9 games just to get through to the final.
Yeah.
And obviously, the 10th game being the final itself. So for us, it was always one game at a time, one round. And we treated every round of the FA Vars as if it was the final. We talk about it now. And if we talk about mindset in football, we were playing a first qualifying round away in Oxfordshire against a team in the league below. And we said in the change room that if we really want to get to the final, we have to treat every game like as if it is the final. And we said, this is our Wembley. And it was a tag that followed us through the whole season. And the players really bought into that, really responded. So we'd go, whether we travelled to the Isle of Wight, went to Manchester, to Somerset, to Devon, Sussex, we travelled all over the place. And no matter what stadium we're playing at, it was, this is Wembley Stadium. And it just clicked and we progressed and kept going and kept believing and it happened.
Well, it obviously was a great approach because it definitely works. But the final itself, look, you know, playing at Wembley, I don't know how you prepare for something like that. You know, would you say how many fans were there? 28,000, did you say?
That's right.
Wow. Do you mean like, how was that and how did you and the players deal with it?
As you say, it's very difficult to plan for a game at Wembley Stadium. We've all seen so many games on TV there or been to the stadium, watched, you know, finals and watch England internationals play. How did we prepare for it? We had 3 weeks from our final game of the season, final league game, and then going into the FA Vars final. So it was just trying to settle the players down more than anything because they were like a bunch of kids that were really excited and couldn't exactly. wait to play.
Yeah.
So we knew it was 3 weeks is a long time to prepare for one game. And we just tried to create an environment that was fun. It was enjoyable for the first 10 days. And then the last 10 days building up to it was more the match preparation. So we would then look at creating experiences that would take the awe off actually playing at Wembley, which is quite a strange thing to say, but we didn't want the players to walk onto the pitch at Wembley and be in awe and freeze, if you like, yep. and underperform. So we arranged a trip to go to Wembley prior to actually playing. We did a stadium tour. We had a chance to walk through the tunnel, be in the changing rooms, walk around the pitch. And it's a chance for them to get their photos, sort of visualize, manifest, however they wanted to do it. And that settled them down. And then after that, we then look at, we didn't arrange any friendlies because we didn't feel like players would really commit to the friendlies with the fear of getting injured. So we had higher tempo training sessions. We went to the Medjeski Stadium in Reading. We trained on their pitch one evening, which was a great experience. So suddenly there's a 25,000 seat stadium you're training in. So already that takes the edge off going to a 90,000
a little bit
stadium. Yeah. And it was, we just tried, the angle we wanted to approach was involving their families, involving their friends, involving everybody around the football club and give them a real purpose to try and win the game for them as well. So we put together a video, which was a secret for the players. And it was a 10-minute video of messages from all of their family, their friends. We had a few well-known celebrities on there as well. And we played that to them the night before of the final. We stayed at a hotel, which was really nice. So in terms of match preparation, we did everything we can to be as professional as we could and give them every opportunity. And the club were so supportive of that. So after that video, you could see that emotionally, it definitely, there was a, it touched them, it connected, it was very emotional.
Yeah.
And I think that was just what we wanted, because that got the emotion as well out of the way before the match day. So it meant match day was here. It was an early, it's a 12:15 kickoff, fortunately. So we're up, we're at breakfast, we're traveling on the Reading first team coach as well. So we traveled in style, and a police escort to the Wembley Stadium as well.
Brilliant.
And it meant that they could really just focus on the game. Photos were done, videos were done, messages were all done. It was, we're here to win a game of football now, like any other game in the country. So it paid off. We won 1-0 and we performed really well. We performed really well. The game plan we looked to do went perfectly. The player we thought would be man of the match and be the best player on the pitch was the man of the match, because we wanted to put him in that position. And the player who scored our goal, Kai Walters, as a story from him is that he's had a lot of injuries in the past over the last few years, in and out of football, lost the love of the game, come back, scored the winner at Wembley and went to win 1-0. And that happens to be his last game of football because he's moving to Australia. So his last ever touch, that was his last touch of the game as well. So his last ever kick in, of the game of, in football was a winning goal at Wembley Stadium to win it. So yeah, unbelievable. So that's how we kind of went about it. And after the game, it was such a huge release of emotion for everybody and a massive party. So it was a phenomenal experience.
What's interesting about that, when you recount, like, you build up towards the big day, it was much more psychological, wasn't it? You know, you didn't talk about football straight away. You're talking about, like, preparing emotionally, getting mindsets right, and that kind of, and, you know, getting comfortable in the surroundings, those kind of things. And again, we're going to come as to hope when we talk about how we relate back to the youth players, but, you know, so much of it is more about attitude and approach, isn't it? And feeling like you can express yourself rather than actually any kind of technical or tactical, you know, planning. Not that that wasn't important, I'm sure, because I'm sure, like you said, you had your game plan, you stuck to it, but that wasn't the first thing that came to your mind when you reflected back on it. It was more getting the players mentally prepared for the situation.
It was, because we knew that that would take a lot out of them. They would be very excited, but, you know, with their, in terms of energy and, yeah, psychologically and physically, we knew that it could take a lot out of them very quickly.
Yeah.
So it'll get to the game and the nerves will just take over, or they'll implode on the pitch. So,
and what you don't want, I guess, is you don't want to have that day and then walk away thinking, oh, if only we could have done that, or only we should have done that. You know, and I know it's not the same as you by any stretch of the imagination, but our little younger ones, we had a good one in the County Cup, which for us is our little equivalent of the FA Cup. Do you know what I mean? And we had a similar thing where we got to the final and we went and we trained at the place a week or so before, just to get used to it, let the boys have half an hour to walk around the changing rooms and get just to, you know, we didn't get a match, a friendly match, for the same reasons you said, but just to get them used to the surroundings. So when the day came, it wasn't quite as, you know, not Wembley Stadium at 28,000, but in our little world, it was a big thing for our little ones. They were 14 years old, so it was a big deal. But it was more that psychological preparation than anything else. Just so we didn't want to, we'll lose or draw, we didn't want to look back and say, oh, we, as coaches or managers, we could have done more to get the players ready for it. You know, the result's the result, right? You can only do so much, but you don't want to reflect back and think, oh, we should have done that or could have done this.
You're absolutely right. No matter whether it's Wembley Stadium or, you know, even for youth players to play at a local non-league ground, which... Exactly. That's very different to a normal pitch on a Sunday, right? So that whole surroundings and preparing them for that, you don't know how they can react. Some will thrive and some won't. If we can prepare them to hopefully help them thrive in it, then that's what we'll definitely try to do. So,
penalties?
We did.
Did you?
After every session, just very, not, you know, quite informally. We just have a quick competition. We didn't really put too much emphasis on it because I didn't want them to think that we couldn't win it in the 90 minutes as well. So, but we'd had won a penalty shootout in the quarterfinals of the FA Vars away in Manchester, and we won the penalty shootout in the semi-finals away in Corsham. So we'd already gone through two rounds winning a penalty shootout. Our goalkeepers made saves in shootouts.
So confidence is high, right? If that was a situation, you don't have to worry too much. You were not in a bad place. Yeah,
Would believe in that as already. So it was more about preparing them to play in front of thousands of people and Wembley Stadium. It was
yeah.
just that trying to get them to thrive in it rather than
yeah
than not. So
well, massive congratulations. Like, well done for a successful season. I don't know where you go next season after the season you just had, but I'll let you focus on that. Getting that bounce back and that focus, I guess. You've got another challenge now in a different league, and you've got a cup to try and retain, I imagine. So you've got your work cut out for next season. But congratulations for all the hard work and effort. You never win a game on the day, do you? It's always months, if not years, in preparation for those moments. So well done to you and the team.
Thank you.
So there's this 20-minute build-up to this conversation really is about, so we can understand the fact you wear two big caps. You've got your Brentford cap, which is all about development and focus and getting, you know, players engaged. You've got 1,300 young players there all like loving their football and getting better. And then you've got Ascot, where you have to go and win stuff to really keep your job in many ways, right? Let's be honest. It's 3 points and cups, let's be honest. So that's why I think you're perfectly positioned to look at this topic around thinking about, maybe let's look at the foundation phase first. What lessons, if anything, could we take from really looking at the adult game to help young players, to be successful in the adult game? And I know we don't want to blur the lines between saying, like, you know, 5-a-side football is the same as 11-a-side football. We know it's not, you know, we know there's differences there, but there's got to be things that healthily we can take out of the adult game and say, right, if I can unpick some of this stuff now, how can I embed some of these things in the young players to help them enjoy their journey and hopefully aspire to the things that your players have achieved last season? Big question there. Apologies for being a bit waffly, but, you know, what's your thoughts around that? And is there things we can take out of that, the adult game, and things you've learned over the last, you know, 6 years at Ascot?
Yeah, sure. So I think for me, if I'm still coaching a group of under sevens, and then I can then coach our first team, first of all, I'd want to make sure that the session's enjoyable. That's a given. I think it's, we play the game because we love it. We're involved in the game because we love it. And I will always say to our players that this will be the most enjoyable place you'll play football, because so often they'll come to me and they wouldn't have enjoyed their football elsewhere. And I just get baffled by that. So for me, and even once a new player joins and suddenly 6 months later, they'll say, this is the best place I've ever played football. There's brilliant.
Yeah, there's your win.
Great. And we're winning whilst we're doing it as well, which the first team level, of course, that's a priority. So the enjoyment factor there, I will make sure that the togetherness of the whole group, the bonding between them, the experiences they have together is all enjoyable. And sometimes it's not just on the pitch. Sometimes it's off the pitch. We might have an experience where we go and do a team building session, whether it's bowling, top golf, join the driving range, something that just takes them away from the football environment and puts them in a setting where they can actually talk to each other about something other than football. And that then brings them closer together as a whole group. They start developing friendships. In it can even go as far as to say they're brothers or sisters, if you've got a girls' team, right? And now the benefits of that in a team setting means that everyone can't wait to train. That's going to be their favorite session, where they can't wait to turn up and play football with their friends. And that is, it's just so important. And it should be the priority for everybody. It is a game of football we love. We need to share that passion. And that's what will keep them playing until they're playing vets football. So that's number one for me.
So keeping it fun, having enjoyment, and making sure that, you know, it feels like a family and they're connected together. And you're saying that's the same approach you'd have potentially with the Ascot first team as you would do with your under sevens at Brentford?
100%.
Yeah. Do you think people get it wrong? Do you think we think, because I'm not, like, I've never coached an adult team, you know what I mean? And honestly, it scares me a little bit. As the old, young ones get older, they're under 15s this season, I feel like I'm more comfortable and capable of getting closer to that. But it's taken me a 10-year journey to feel like I could even consider it. And I prefer the younger ones personally. I think I can relate to them better because I've got, I think, like a 7-year-old, so I can coach 7-year-olds. It's easy for me. But do you think there's a misconception that when coaching, that actually, you know what, as you know, you get serious about your football and you kind of get to the adult, or even under 18s, under 23s and first teams, you know, you've got to change everything. It's got to be now, it's got to be much more about, like, you know, drills and, you know, and being kind of, you know, shouty, and although we see some of that at younger age groups, we know that, but, you know, is that, do you think that's a bit of a misconception that actually you haven't got to be that way?
I think so. I think it becomes a little bit too serious at times. I think everyone wants to win the game, so that never changes, and the competitive edge never changes. But if it's all the time, if you don't win, then you're setting yourself up to fail, because if you do lose, that means everybody is, the reactions, the body language, the comments are just negative, and it creates a negative environment. Then who wants to play in that? So, whereas we have had we've had a successful season, but not just this season, previous years, if we had a loss or we drew a game that we should have won, even sometimes if we've won the game but not played well, there's moments where they'll be disappointed, but it's like, right, boys, come on, we know we're better than that. Let's make sure that we're back at training, we're working hard, and we'll get through it, and we'll give everything to win the next game. And that's the attitude you want. Yeah. So, and there is an element of, there's time to be serious, of course, but then they know when to switch in, and they know when to then switch out of that to have a bit more fun. So it's getting that blend right. If it's just all one way, that's when there could potentially be some issues and problems. It's getting the blend right.
Yeah.
Because at the end of the day, we all do want to play. But as you get older, the competitive edge really kicks in, and we all want to win, right? So it's getting that blend right. There's moments to really enjoy it, and I think that's normally the start of the session. The games at the end is always enjoyable. That middle section for us is always about, right, we're here to prep for the game, here to plan, prepare. This is how we're going to win the game.
And how would your session, I guess, planning, preparation and delivery compare, if at all, to like the adult world? So like your first team compared to like the foundation phase at Brentford, you know, are there any similarities in how you'd prepare and plan and deliver a training session, or are they completely different?
Yeah, it's the similarities. I think differences would be first part of the session, whether it would be the warm-up, it could be a lot of ball mastery stuff, a lot of individual coaching for the group, for younger players. It could then move into 1v1 scenario. So it's more about that individual, especially for younger age groups. You want to be working with the individual for as much as you can throughout the whole session. But as they start getting into the teenage years, into, you know, beyond the foundation phase, it's about, well, okay, we need to teach them the game. So it becomes the game related situations, the working in units, working as a team. And then you take it into the game at the end, where they can just, you know, put all that into practice. I would definitely advise, you know, I've always worked with younger players in the foundation phase to be ball each for as long as possible, under competition, under being opposed, if possible, which sometimes, you know, sometimes it has to be unopposed, depending on the skill you're working on. But a lot of 1v1 situations, a lot of 2v2s, 3v3s, overloads, underloads, giving them the ball at their feet as much as possible, giving them many different scenarios and decisions to make on the ball. And that's what's going to help them develop as an individual. And as that progresses in the years through their youth, it does become more about the impact they can have as an individual, but also the person next to them. So that's then the unit and around them. And then as you get to those later teenage years and youth development phase and senior football, it's about, right, less about the individual. It's more about how, as we as a team, set up to get the best out of all of us, and how can we win the game? And look, end of the session is always a game. I think I'd love just to play games all the time, right? So that's always the fun part.
And do you look at, don't name names here, obviously, but do you look at some of your first team players and think, actually, you know what, maybe they had an opportunity when they were younger to spend more time on a ball, therefore their technical ability and ball management skills are kind of strong, and others that have got, I'm sure, attributes as well, but maybe more limited in what they can do because they didn't have that. Can you look at an older player and look back and almost see potentially what path they had when they were younger?
Oh, you can tell that straight away. You can
Yeah.
tell that straight away. First session, no problem. You can see players that are really comfortable on the ball, that have good first touches and good ball manipulation. Players that are good 1v1. You can see players that really understand the tactical elements of the game, knowing when to press, how to press, for example, when to drop off, the body shape looks like. You can really see it. And you can put non-league footballers, especially defenders, into categories. And you can have, we call them head and kick it players.
Yeah.
Head and kick it defenders.
Yeah.
But don't get me wrong, they're your best defenders on an away pitch, which is really muddy and raining.
Very effective, right? And what they do, they can be very effective. And
in a game that's very direct,
yep.
they're going to be your best defenders. But if you're playing on a national turf 3G pitch, which we do have, we're asking players to be in possession a lot more. And if we can build it through the thirds, perfect. There's some players that can do it, there's some that definitely can't. And it's difficult to teach them that as they're into their early 20s, mid-20s, even into their 30s. But there's players I've worked with that are in their mid to late 30s who have been in the non-league game for years and years and years. And they would have picked up their own quirks and their own habits, and it works for them. So you can't just dismiss it, because it works for them and it gets some goals. Or it worked, they've had a real good non-league career out of it. So, yeah, you can really tell the difference from the first session.
I think it's funny, isn't it? Because until you kind of almost see the whole journey through, you don't necessarily realise just how impactful, you know, we can be as coaches in that foundation phase, you know, and the environments we create and what we encourage the players to do in the time we've got them, you know, that makes a massive difference. You don't get that under seven seasons back again. Once it's gone, it's gone. So you can't go back under 10s to under 7s again. You've kind of got to move through your age group. So, and I guess you see that at the sharp end where, you know, a great player nonetheless, I'm sure, would be like, oh, you know, if only they had done a bit more this maybe, or, you know, or they are great, so great because of what they did do. So in addition to obviously keeping it fun, enjoyment, creating that family environment, obviously ball manipulation, ball skills and being good on the ball, what about mindset in the foundation phase? You know, I'm sure with your older players, with the first team at Ascot, you know, that I don't know how much you focus on it as a thing. Are they expected to come and have that, you know, desire to want to win that, or is that part of your sessions? And then feeding back now, how would you embed some of these stuff, maybe, you know, under 7s, 8s, 9s? Can you embed some of that stuff that they'll need at under 23s and older? Is it possible to do that?
I believe so. I think developing training sessions that is built, that creates a desire to compete, whether that's a 1v1 situation, the desire is to beat the player and the end result would be to get it through a gate or something, or scoring a goal, and it's a score. It's a goal. So I think sessions that evolve around goals and a score would help build that desire and also resilience if you're losing. So it's how you react to the losses, how you deal with that, how you can respond, how can you try to change that to start winning. So, and it's based on that session design. If it involves competition, if it involves something to work towards. So we would play games at the end, and we won't just play games just for the sake of it, saying 10 minutes, here's a game, off you go. The second I will say, okay, we're playing for 3 points in this game. And this could be 5v5s. This is 5v5 stuff. And there's three teams. Playing for 3 points, you've got 3 minute games, and you play each team twice, and suddenly a league table's created. Suddenly the tempo of the session and the attitude is so much better because there's something to play for, something to work towards. Now that for the foundation phase, that might not be playing for points and then having a league table, but it's what's the outcome to them doing something well? Is there a purpose to it? And I think that then changes the whole mindset of the player. They're doing it for a reason. They're doing it to score a goal. They're not just dribbling it to a line, because no one wants to dribble it to a line. They want to score in a goal. So that's the kind of stuff I think you could start to drip feed it in. 100%. That's where you get the desire to do that. It builds the resilience. It has the attitude to work hard as well, and you can build that naturally within training sessions. It builds enthusiasm. Everyone wants to have players that are enthusiastic. The second you put goals in a session, they're like, okay, brilliant, great, let's play. So it makes such a world of a difference.
And if you're looking at an adult player, then a first team player, what attributes do you think, you know, broadly speaking, would make a successful player? You've been around successful teams, you know, that, like, I guess physically, technically, psychologically, you know, what things, you know, are the common factors you see, actually, you know, what I see in good players are these things. They've got this about them that kind of tends to mean they're going to probably do well.
Yeah, they have a willingness to work hard in everything they do. I think that's number one. I think if we had a choice, we would have 11 players that are work hard over 11 players that are really more talented but don't work hard.
Absolutely.
And the attitude of the player to want to learn stands out. And then you build onto players that have, I think for our team, and of course this is different for everybody, and it could be right, it could be wrong, but this is how we approach it with our club and our players at first team level. We'd pin it down to four key values, which is passion. We want players to feel passionate about the game and love what they do, really love what they do. An attitude, a great attitude, which revolves around wanting to learn and doing the basics really well, turning up on time, wearing the right clothing, simple things which all add up. Togetherness of the group. So again, it's building, contributing to that environment to make it a positive one. And then hard work, that's number one for us, underpins all of the above.
And are those four core values that you speak about kind of overtly? Would the players know these values? Is it something you talk about and practice and, you know, discuss?
Yeah, they're words that we would frequently bring up. They will talk about it themselves. It's something that we, to be at our best, we need to have those four things. No matter what.
It spells path as well, you know. Is that a conscious thing? It spells path. Is this the journey you're on?
I'm glad you picked that up.
Togetherness, hard work. That's your path together, is it?
It is. I'm glad you picked it up, because we would say it's our path to success.
Fantastic. Love it. Really good. Superb. I'm a big believer in core values and behaviours and just, but I think the mistake we can make sometimes is, as coaches, we believe in it. We put it down, we put the words and we understand it. But the challenge is, how do you get it into the players to have the same passion and buy into it and see it, you know? And I think sometimes that, you know, the theory bit is all well and good, but how do you get it out in practice? And, well, I mean, they're four good values there. And do you find you spend time trying to get the players to understand the path? Is it, you know, is it a conscious part of what you do as your sessions?
Yeah, of course. I think with anything we would do in training, there's a reason, there's a purpose to it. And then what helps off the back of that is, if you're the players at first team level, is if you're winning games, because they then believe in it even more.
Exactly. Yeah.
So, and fortunately, we did have a very successful season last year, and they've now understood what has got them to that place in the first, you know, got them to that position to win. And it's not just about this ball goes, needs to go here, and this is how we're going to score. It's about all this stuff before you even enter the pitch.
It's the whole process, right?
It's the whole process. Yeah. And we haven't deliberately sat down with them at the start and said, this is the process, this is how it's going to work. It's evolved over time, naturally. And we would pick up on these key words that we wanted from our players, and now we've just put it down a bit more formally. So it's a bit more of it's our identity. And we would we have team meetings regularly. We'll just, any new player that joins the group, we'll ensure that they are aware of that moving forwards. And I think that just puts us in good stead.
Yeah, fantastic. Okay, a couple of other areas to think about here then, because again, we want to differentiate between the adult game and youth football, but also trying to pick the bits where we can, you know, get some transference. Another grey area, I guess, would be position-specific players, you know. So at what point do you become the striker and the left back? I mean, it still grinds me now. I had a message yesterday from a coach who coaches under sevens, and it was like, our striker was fantastic on Sunday. And I think, you know, under sevens, you don't have a striker under sevens. But, you know, again, I just, you know, let it go. But it's, you know, but at some point, you know, and also what I have learned a little bit here is actually some players, you know, they do want to play in one position and they're very good at it. And you've got to let that unfold a little bit as well and maybe encourage things. But what's your take on when a player maybe should cement himself like around one or two positions? Is it something you think should happen at some stage or should it be continuously fluid?
Yeah, I think it gets to around the 13, 14 mark for me where you can start to narrow it down to three positions. And those three positions could link really nicely. So instead of having a right back and a left winger, which is completely opposite parts of the pitches, you might have a player who can do. Let's just use right back as an example, and you're playing 11 aside. If that player could play as a centre back, a right winger, they've got that triangle of positions in there. And if you've got more to that, you've got centre midfielder. You can it's not too far away from a right back. Obviously, you've got the other left, you know, other fullback position. You've got players that can be utilised in different ways, and it creates a more rounded player. Wingers, we obviously have a lot of in the game. You have wingers that will play on both sides of the pitches, on the right side and the left side, so they've got a different perspective. And I think even centre backs to centre midfielders and. I've not seen many times your goalkeeper play out on a different position, but I think in when you start to before you get to that point of really narrowing down their positions, it's about them discovering what they can do in other positions, under sevens through to under 12s, rotating positions, different sides of the pitch. It's not, sometimes rotating positions could be okay. Now you're going to be a right-sided defender. Now, next week, you're going to be a right-sided midfielder. But can it be a left-sided midfielder? Because that's putting them in a different part of the pitch and it's creating them different pictures using different parts of their foot, their body shape, different perspective on how to play the ball forwards, how to take on players. And goalkeepers can go into centre-back position as a defender. So they get to understand what that role is like so that when they go back in goal, they have more of an understanding of how to help that player in front of them. And it's allowing those players to really discover where on the pitch is it, you know, eventually would work out best for them. And as you say, so often you'd get parents, coaches that will say, my child is a striker. My child is a left winger, but they're only playing seven aside. So, it still happens.
Yeah.
And I would encourage many, many coaches to keep changing the positions around, really mixing it up. And until they get to the 11-a-side game, that's when you can start to narrow it down. It might, players might have four or five positions then, but by the time they're 14, 15, 16, it's really narrowing it down to that triangle of positions where it's relatable. And then they can really focus on that craft of that position.
And I guess also you'd hope that really, if you play one position, like the more modern football now, right, you're not doing one job, are you? Like, you know, 20 years ago, centre-back was a centre-back, weren't they? I mean, you pretty much, you know, you got the ball, we've gone and cleared the ball. Like now centre-backs, you know, you want them to be able to receive, play out from the back under pressure. So like the attributes that a centre-back has is, you know, they're similar to what a centre midfield player would have, a CDM, you know, potentially absolutely. A right-back. So even if you're in one position, encourage your players to do more stuff in that role, right? And don't just, you know, don't think traditionally, think more modern and be an well-rounded player. Because if you've got 11 players in all positions that can do everything, then that's the dream, right? Surely.
Yeah, of course. You look at Liverpool in a moment and Trent Alexander-Arnold, right, who he's been one of the best fullbacks in the country in recent years, has now played centre midfield for Liverpool as well. So, yes. And even for England. So, that's
when you look at his heat map as well in games, most of his possession and positioning is in the opposition half. Like, yeah, you know, he's like, he's not the old fashioned right back, is he? Where he'd stand there and just, you know, those days have gone, haven't they? And we've got to think as coaches, especially in the foundation phase, you know, what it's going to be like in 10 or 15 years time, not even today's football, right? And it's only going to probably get more fluid and, you know, require a wider skill set from players. It probably won't regress. So we've got to find ways to do that.
Absolutely. In grassroots football, it's about giving the players a more rounded experience and opportunity to develop different parts of their game and eventually getting to that point where you can narrow down and give that triangle of positions. But then if they do go into the non-league game, which many grassroots players, if they were to continue, may well end up in, rather than a professional game. If, as me as a non-league manager, was to select a player, I'm going to select a player who can play in different positions.
Absolutely.
And over one that is just isolated to one. So, and even in our selection, we've signed five players this summer to a team that's just won at Wembley. All those five players we've brought in can play more than one position because we want to have the flexibility. We want the versatility in the squad. So otherwise you'll end up having too many players. You can't have two left backs in a squad.
Such a powerful statement that is, Jamie. Straight away, the fact that, you know, you brought in five players and one of your key focuses is that versatility, right? Because it allows you, I guess, to make changes in games about formations, tactics, approaches to play. Because you know, like you say, you can't have 30 subs. You need to work with you've got. So, yeah, I wonder if that does resonate that back down. Because again, like sometimes I will feel like actually first team football has more of a development approach to it than sometimes what I see in youth football. Because, you know, you kind of have to because of restrictions on like you say, numbers or money and things like that. Where in the youth football, it's almost, there's no restrictions. You can do what you want to do. There's loads of players and you've got, you know, you've got no one looking after you. So do you think some of that stuff does get missed sometimes?
I think so. I think it's improved.
Yeah. Yeah,
got better, 100%. I think just if the priority for teams and coaches is to win the game, their best player is always playing in that one position. So eventually that will catch up on them as well. Yeah. And if that best player has only played one position in their whole youth football experience and career, they'll actually be quite limited when they go in, unless they're outstanding, of course. If you have outstanding youth players that will play in one position, and it does happen, but more often than not, it doesn't. So they'll get to a stage where they're playing suddenly under 18s football, under 21s football, and then they've got other players around them who have caught up physically, psychologically, technically, who can be more flexible, versatile on the pitch that will then start to get ahead of them.
You touched on this as well. What's your experience of kind of the whole adolescence and puberty phases? Because again, with the older group now, I've got under 15s this season. We've seen those changes over the last year or two. And obviously some boys have gone through it. Some are there, some are not quite there yet. But it's almost going back to under 5-6s where like the range in size and body shape and where they are is phenomenal. And actually those that are going through change as well, they often, their performance can drop a little bit because understandably they just, you know, their body's readjusting again. So what's your experience of that? And when they come through the other side, have you seen players change, like in the sense of maybe where they play on a pitch, or does it balance out again to what they were doing before? It's just a bit of a journey to go through. Or can it make a big difference where suddenly, you know, your star striker is now going to be your best centre-back, or your best centre-back is going to be your left winger? Can that happen?
It does happen. It happens very frequently, for sure. So players, as you say, they develop at different rates. And they grow and then they and suddenly they are 6 foot tall.
Yeah.
And their game can really develop because partly that it can work for them, it can work against them. So normally those that are developing quicker will suddenly become stronger than others, they'll become faster than others, and they'll then start to really excel. And then they suddenly will have less priority or less reliability, I should say, of their technical ability. Because if they can push the ball past a player and run past them because they're bigger and quicker, that's an easy thing for them to do. But when they catch up, the other boys catch up, they can't do that no more. they have to rely again on their technical ability to get them out of trouble or progress on the pitch. And that happens very, very, very often. And also, as you mentioned about positions, I've seen it happen before where players would naturally fit a different position because of the physical traits and attributes they've got. Suddenly they've become very quick. They've become very quick. So they, instead of being a centre midfielder or a midfielder, they're actually getting more success now as a wide player, as a winger, or as a forward, or as a defender, as a centre back, because it's great having a centre back who's quick. Most of them are slow. That's how it can change. And I think once players discover that, having had the opportunity to try those positions when they're younger anyway, they're more in tune to do it and encouraged to do that because they know that's a more of a strength for them and it gets the best out of them.
So in summary then, on kind of this kind of, what can we take from the adult game and put into youth football? If there was maybe, I don't know, just a few top tips, if you were, you know, if you're looking or going to give some advice to, say, a group of coaches that are coaching under sevens, eights, nines, tens, you know, what would you say? Look, you know, if you want to get your kids ready for in 10 years time, these are the things that I would say you might want to think about, you know, with regards to your approach to your sessions, or what you might want to embed in your sessions, you know, in addition to maybe, you know, the enjoyment bit and, you know, the family bit and that kind of stuff, keeping it right and the ball skills. Anything more broadly you would talk about, and more specific you would talk about?
I would say focus on the individual for as long as possible.
Yeah.
Less about the team, because, you know, if you win 5-0, you lose 5-0, it doesn't really matter. It doesn't really matter. It's about the learning experience the players have had. So as an individual, how can we help those young players be better with the ball at their feet? Because there's no point making them run shuttles or making them run laps around the pitch, because it doesn't make a difference to their physical attributes. Scientifically doesn't make a difference. So until they're 14, 15, 16. So if we can spend more time on the ball, focused on the individual, rotating those positions to give a more of a rounding experience, suddenly you get to 12, 13 years old and you've got a group of players that can play off both feet in multiple positions. Longer term development means more success for that individual.
I think you summed that up very nicely. And it's not rocket science, I guess, is it? You know, just the challenge, I guess, for us as coaches when we're running little teams is to see past the team, isn't it, in the younger age groups and encourage the individual flair and stay on the ball and be brave. And I think, you know, that it's a battle for us as coaches, but you have to be like, if you're going to do the right thing by the players, then you've got to do the right thing by the players. You know, it's not about your ego or, you know, like the 3 points or winning. And that's why we don't have 3 points in the foundation phase. But you wouldn't know that when you talk to a lot of the coaches, because they still keep their own league tables and do things. And I think, oh, you're going to get distracted by not sticking to, you know, what's best for the players, or at least, you know, getting that balance right between, okay, you know, having that team environment, but also that individual stuff. I know there'll be coaches listening that will be keen. Maybe they're working with younger players right now because that's where they're at, but they have aspirations to go and work with first teams and get into adult and senior football. Would you have any tips for them with regards to how they might develop themselves as coaches now, not as players, but as coaches, from going from that, maybe that foundational YDP phase to actually first team, you know, top end football where you can get to play at Wembley?
Yeah, sure. I mean, most clubs have a huge youth section, or a youth section that has older age groups. So I would always encourage them to go and watch other coaches, whether it's at their own club or other clubs, or clubs like Brentford, come to watch our sessions and our coaches, and get to understand what it's like to coach a 12-year-old player, what it's like to coach a 14-year-old player, a 16-year-old player. And then most clubs will have a partnership or have their own teams that are under 18s, under 21s, under 23s, or first team. And it's about watching that environment and seeing what it's like and picking up tips to what works well and what doesn't work well, because they are relatable. And I have a lot of coaches from Ascot United, and as I mentioned earlier on, one of the largest clubs in the country. A lot of the grassroots coaches would watch my training sessions, and they would sit on the side and they'd watch, and they'll always comment on them and say, "I really like what you did there. You know, how can I use that for my team? How can I use that for my under 15s? How can I use that for my under 13s?" And they'll look at that enjoyment factor, and they see how much the players are enjoying it, and they're sweating, they're working hard, and they'll say, "Oh, can you show me how you did that and how you got that to work? Because I want to do it with my team." And the next week, I'm there. I'm always there early to watch some youth teams train, and they're doing it, and they're getting the benefits of it. And suddenly, this whole environment of youth players that could potentially play in my team in a few years' time are training as if they're training for that moment. So they're getting a lot of enjoyment, and they're starting to progress.
You're going to have like about 300 coaches come down to your next training session.
Oh, listen to the podcast
or watching.
Everyone's more than welcome.
One of them will be me. Jamie, thank you so much. I really appreciate that. It's not an easy topic to kind of unpick, because kind of a bit of a fine line between where do you go with it, in the sense of, we don't want to say 5-a-side, 7-a-side, 9-a-side is the same as adult football. Even 11-a-side under 14s isn't adult football, right? It's different. But there are correlations, and there are things I think that, if we tread carefully, we can unpick, which will hopefully help the players, get to their best potential when they get to that, that first team kind of stuff. So thank you for putting some of that together. Really appreciate it. Brentford, let's finish on Brentford a little bit. How is it going? What's exciting plans moving forward? How's things looking for the future?
Yeah, very exciting. Obviously, moving into the Premier League and staying in the Premier League is allowed us to think differently about how we move forward as a football club, as a community sports trust. More in particular for me, the community sports trust. We're now just trying to source more venues in our local community where we can set up more training sessions and engage with more young people, because we have got a lot of demand at the moment. So we're just trying to work out ways where we can encourage and engage with more young people to join Brentford sessions. Also, being in the Premier League means that the football club is going to bring back the academy. And as part of the EPPP program, that is now fully underway and the academy is returning. So there's a long process to get towards that, and we're still probably 12 months away from getting to that point, but there's that's all started as well. So lots going on in the background, as well as lots of stuff happening out on the pitches.
Well, it's fantastic. I'm lucky enough to have some of our players that are involved, in the academy, I think, in that process, also in the trust. And everyone speaks so highly of you, the work you do, the team, the competitions that you run, everything you do. So you're doing a fantastic job. It seems like it's never ending. It just gets bigger and bigger. So you're always very busy. And then with the Ascot stuff as well, it really is, nonstop for you. So I'm grateful for your time today, Jamie. Will you come back on and do a hat-trick at some point before 4 years?
Oh, of course. Yeah, that sounds great. Yeah. And thank you so much for the kind words as well. And as you mentioned, most recently competition, the Gunnersbury Cup, which you brought your teams to, and they did really well. So it's a competition. If anyone's listening, any coaches got teams, want to bring them to the Gunnersbury Cup, then that's an annual competition that's really growing fast.
It's superb. It really is. We'll put a link in the show notes to it so people can find it nice and easy. But Jane, back to your point you made in the conversation, look, I want to win every game I play as a coach, every game I want to play, but I want to win it the right way, at least what I deem to be the right way. And I know it can be quite subjective, but we don't pigeonhole players, we make equal game time. We try and make it more about them. We try and get them involved in the process. But winning competitions like the one, like the Gunnersbury Cup one, what it allows you to do then is give the players belief in the process, right? And that was the thing. So, and that was, I think it was both age groups won it, but the 14s, for them, It was the first thing they won under our little umbrella after one season of being together. And it was so nice because even the young ones, who were a very strong team, it took them a whole season before we started winning stuff, you know, in inverted commas, because, you know, it just took a little while things to click together. And they've won something in their first season. And I saw it in the boys. It was just right. Actually, you know what? Scott isn't talking nonsense. Actually, you know what? If we do work hard and follow the behaviours and do the right things and trust him and be brave on the ball and do that stuff, then actually we can also get across the line. You know, how much is nice getting the trophies? It is about just, I think, you know, giving confidence to the players that actually please believe in the process, because hopefully that will build on further.
Absolutely. And I watched one of those finals against another side that was very, very good. And the football that was being played by all of the players was a very, very high standard. You know, there's lots of 1v1 situations, lots of overloads and recognition of when to dribble, when to pass. There were players on there that were very, very comfortable with the ball at their feet.
And I think that's, you know, and that's in the final, right? And when you've got players can do that in the final, and that's when you think the environment's been set for them right, hasn't it, you know? And yeah, it's fantastic. So no, great work. We'll put the link into the Grimsby Cup competition for what will be next year now, right? But we'll put it in there. And we look forward to being there again. I think we've got tickets to come and watch Brentford Lille on Saturday, which will be great as well for one of their pre-season games. So thank you for that. And yeah, keep up the great work, Jamie. It's been a pleasure speaking to you again. And congratulations again for last season.
Brilliant. Thanks very much. And for all the great work on the podcast, it's brilliant.
Cheers, Jamie. This episode was brought to you in association with our friends at Soccer Coach Weekly. Established since 2006, Soccer Coach Weekly is a leading source of inspiration and advice for all grassroots coaches. Join thousands of youth soccer coaches just like you, saving time and effort in their goal of having the most effective, enjoyable and successful coaching journey for them and their players. Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the episode. We'll be right back.